Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, a wordsmith.
What? You know, like in Beowulf.
That's right, and on today's episode, Aaron is going to recite all of Beowulf in Old English in its entirety, starting now.
Oh, shit, okay. So there's something about a whale road. I remember that.
Yes.
Mad Max Whale Road.
Yes, that's exactly
okay.
It. Well done. Okay. And on the rest of the episode, we are going to be talking all about talking and reading and writing. Because we are talking about language. In particular, the English one. That's the one that we are speaking right now.
If you didn't know.
And we're going to be talking you through all the many different ways, or at least some of them, that the English language changed throughout the Middle Ages. From a backwater collection of various West Germanic dialects to, well, not the global superpower language that it is today, but how it gets set on that path by the end of the Middle Ages.
That's right. By the end of the Middle Ages, it was bussin' for real.
That's right.
I thought it would be apropos, since we're talking about language change, to just sprinkle in a few bits of language change that have happened in my lifetime that I find completely baffling.
Yeah, no, I agree. It would be poggers.
Skibbity toilet. Yes.
There's nothing you can really say to that, is there?
The feast is o'er. Now brimming wine in lordly cup is seen to shine before each eager guest. And silence fills the crowded hall, as deep as when the herald's call thrills in the loyal breast.
All right, moving swiftly on.
It's hard to know where exactly to start with English because its roots go, well, all the way back to the start of human language, and nobody really knows anything about that. I think the next best place to start, however, is in the 5th century, the early 5th century AD, as the Roman Empire begins to withdraw its presence from Britain.
To understand how English comes to be, you have to understand what Ingerland was without English. And the answer is, it was a backwater Roman province full of a bunch of Celtic people.
Yeah. England, as we know it, didn't exist. The name England and the concept of the English language would have meant absolutely nothing to anyone on the island of currently known as Great Britain. And even the people who would be eventually become known as English people, their ancestors had nothing to do with that island as of yet. So by around AD 400, most of the south of Britain was a Roman province. So basically all of the south of Great Britain, including Wales and Cornwall. The urban elites of the British population spoke Latin. It was a province that was governed by Rome. It was under Roman rule. There was trade with Rome. And so from what we can surmise, most of the people living in big cities, even if they were natives, probably did adopt a lot of Roman customs and culture, including their language.
Well, we know it. Empirically, we do. We literally know it because they kept buying Roman stuff. Like, we need to get all the hot new jugs from Tuscany.
Exactly.
However, Tuscan jugs.
However, most of the population of the island spoke native Celtic languages. And in particular, they probably spoke Celtic language or group of dialects that we now know as Common Brittonic or Common Brythonic. And this is, as we know, a Celtic language, but we don't know a lot beyond that. We know that it was part of the insular family of Celtic languages because it would go on to diverge into such languages as Welsh, Cornish, and Breton. And so that makes it different, crucially, from the Celtic languages spoken in Ireland and in continental Europe. However, we don't know a lot beyond that. We don't have any confirmed written sources for this language. We have a few extremely contentious ones that could be brief inscriptions of names or place names in Brittonic, but very, very little beyond that. So the Romans withdrew from Britain starting in 410 because they had bigger fish to fry. Their empire was rapidly starting to not exist. And so they peaced out. And it's hard to know exactly what they left behind. So this whole province of Roman Britain had probably experienced quite a bit of chaos in the run-up to this. There had probably been quite a few military threats, both from the north of the island and from Germanic raiders coming across the channel. The economy probably wasn't great. Like, the stock market was probably way down. Livestock was probably not a good investment.
The livestock market, total shit show.
But beyond that, we don't actually know very much about what happened in the following decades, do we?
Not. Our best sort of source for this period is a guy who lived maybe 100 years later, called Gildas, who was writing basically a polemic about his generation of politicians that happens to incidentally bring up the stuff that happens in this sort of, in this immediate sort of post-Roman British period that also is in a lot of places directly contradicted by archaeology. So we know basically, we know nothing. I mean, we know that at some point in the 5th century, the Roman legions would leave, and then at some point, potentially after that, there is a rebellion of the native Britons against their local Roman officials for reasons that we don't fully know. It may be they were just sort of felt that they were not being properly protected now that there weren't a bunch of big burly Italian men hanging around. Don't worry, I know people from the legions came from all over Europe and Africa. Don't write to me.
That's an even bigger loss, right? You lose your burly Italians, your burly Scythians, you know, your, I don't know, burly Gauls.
But yeah, no, so Britain's unprotected. The native Britons rise up against the Romans because they're like, right, you guys are doing an absolutely terrible job of protecting us against these raiders from Ireland, from the north of Britain, and from the continent, who go by a variety of names. We'll meet some of them later, and essentially kick them out, and that makes things a hell of a lot worse, because now there is no sort of, as far as we can tell, no centralized authority. There's some possible arguments that maybe, like, the local governments were preserved, but we generally know that two things happened. Number one, there was a total economic collapse. So there was what you might call in economics complete and utter de-development, where basically the cities are more or less abandoned. People go back to the countryside, they rev-turn and get a lot poorer, while the Roman cities just sort of molder away, basically, yeah. Because there's not the economic complexity to support major urban centers, because it's harder and harder and harder to import stuff from Europe because of the political instability.
Right? And currency essentially becomes worthless.
Yeah.
They go back mostly to a barter system.
Yeah. Exactly. And coin, I mean, some later kings will end up sort of minting their own coins. But yeah, in this immediate kind of period, like, you do have just total economic collapse. And that's the first thing that we know happens. The second thing that we know happens, or we think we know happens, based on Gildas's account, is that the native Britons then do a very Roman thing, which is they say to a nearby Germanic tribe, hey, can you, like, come and fight for us, please? Things aren't going well for me.
Yep.
I need a win.
So, let's take a couple steps back for just a second. So yeah, Gildas, despite being from Britain, is writing this after the fact, so it is hard to know. But let's take a step back and look at what we know about this situation from what's generally accepted by historians. So, despite managing to campaign successfully in the very north of the British Isles, in what's now Scotland, the Romans never really managed to subdue it. It's not known whether they completely conquered the place and just kind of realized it wasn't worth it and left. They did have some pretty big military successes in the north of Scotland, so part of the myth that Scotland has never been conquered is not necessarily completely factual, because what seems to have happened is the Romans marched up there, stabbed some local tribes, and then looked around at the, you know, dense, terrifying forests and barren heathlands and thought, no,
well,
we have bigger fish to fry on the continent.
I think the more relevant consideration is not so much what they made of Scotland, but the fact that expansion at that point, expansionary military adventures were basically suicidal for Rome when you have that many problems.
Yeah.
Like, the idea, like, so yeah, they were able to quote unquote conquer Scotland, but they were not able to establish any kind of stable imperial presence.
No, they did not occupy Scotland.
No. They got there, like, we have to go all the way back now.
Basically.
Back down this big island, this incredibly long island.
Yeah. And the people living in the north of Great Britain continued after this fact to raid and basically maraud across the border and across the couple of walls that the Romans had built to mark the border between us versus them.
Yeah. And we're not giving them a name, by the way, because we don't know what they are.
Yes.
The Romans call them the Caledonians. There's a later people who get called the Picts, who they may be descended from the people that the Romans call the Caledonians, but we don't know. And also, the Picts are so impenetrable in and of themselves that actually being able to say that, oh, these guys are Picts, doesn't really help us that much.
Yes. And so in absence of any Roman authority or military might, a raiding from across that border probably begins to intensify quite a bit. Again, not something that's directly attested, but something that we can surmise. In fact, I think we have a quote from Gildas that is allegedly, according to him, a plea for help from the Britons to the continent.
To Agitus, thrice consul, the groans of the Britons. The barbarians drive us to the sea. The sea drives us to the barbarians. Between these two means of death, we are either killed or drowned. And also, I should say that these mysterious northern people are not the only people who are coming along and messing up the Britons. We also have people coming over from Ireland, or possibly a different part of Scotland, who are confusingly called the Scotty.
Yep.
But that is a... Don't read anything into that. That was just the word for people who spoke Irish at the time. And so we don't know where they were coming from, whether they were coming from what we now call Scotland, part of which was Irish-speaking, or if they came from Ireland itself. But the point being, the vultures are circling.
Yes, very much so. So, again, let's step back and look across the English Channel at what's going on in northwestern Europe. And so, in particular, let's take a look at the people who speak what will eventually develop into English. So this is kind of the first step of our English journey, to put it in really obnoxious terms.
I'm going on a journey.
Yeah, basically.
All right,
lads.
It's me.
The Jutes, the Angles, and the Frisians are going to go across the water.
It's me, the first king of the Anglo-Saxons, Jason Statham.
Yep.
It's a Meg! There's a Meg in the English Channel!
That happened, yeah. That's in the Chronicles too.
That's in Bede.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's generally agreed that the people who came to Britain spoke what is now known as West Germanic dialects. And so, we don't know necessarily if these people had a name for their own language, but they were Germanic tribes who spoke what is the ancestor language or dialects of modern English, Dutch, Frisian, and High and Low German. And in particular, the dialects that would eventually become specifically English, Frisian, and Saxon, and eventually Low German. So those all form their own little subgroup of the West Germanic languages. So these languages were not written down. These people, like the Celtic Britons, were illiterate and would be for quite some time. But linguists do actually try to reconstruct these languages based on the existing evidence we have, in particular evidence from their daughter languages, the languages they evolved into. So this will be our first sort of look at what these languages actually sounded like thousands of years ago, which is quite fun. This is a really tricky area, kind of linguistically. It is not precise and it's not infallible. This whole practice of reconstructing extinct languages, or and in particular languages that were never written down, so they're often called unattested languages. But I think it's super fun because you get to just look at existing languages and just reconstruct things that were never written down. I mean, that's that's wild. So let's just take one little example from these dialects, which are known as Proto-West Germanic. And so it's difficult to do this at a very granular level that actually is going to reflect the true variations and nuances in how the different speakers of these languages pronounced words, because there certainly were regional variations and cultural variations. But a little bit like reconstructing images of what dinosaurs looked like from fossils, to harken back a couple episodes before. If we apply some theoretical reasoning and understanding of the processes that govern change, and we look at related species and living descendants of these languages, then we can hopefully get a good idea, but it is still guesswork. We will never actually be able to check our answers against anything. But with that out of the way, let's take a look at the word king. So this will be a very simplified process. Linguists, don't at me. I've chosen a very simple example on purpose. There's a lot more to it than just this. A lot of it is knowing, like, hyper-specific rules about sound change, which we won't go into. So these proto-West Germanic-speaking tribes, we don't know what their what their word for king was. We don't know what their word for anything was directly. But we do know the words for king in Old English was kooning. The word in Old Frisian was caning. In Old Saxon, it was kooning. In Old Dutch, it was koonink. And in Old High German, it was kooning. And so to give you a simplified look at how we might go back and reconstruct the word that all of these words came from.
I'm going to suspect it sounds something like kooning.
Yes, you would suspect correctly. So we look at, first of all of these words begin with a K sound. So they probably all came from a word that started with that sound. Now, not all of them have that oo sound as the first vowel. Notably, a Frisian doesn't. But it's much, much more reasonable for us to surmise that they came from a word that had that oo sound, and one of those languages, Frisian, happened to undergo a sound change into caning, than would it be for us to surmise that, or suppose that, somehow all of the other four languages, which would have diverged from each other at this point, all just happened to experience the same sound change, coincidentally. And so because of that, we will choose to say that the next sound will be that oo. And so in similar fashion, looking at the last sound, it's only in Old Dutch that we don't have that ing ending, and we have an inc ending.
Which is very similar as a sound.
Yes, yes, exactly. And so we will then, exactly as Aaron said, we will surmise that the word that this was derived from was something like kooning. And so by going through that process, actually linguists can reconstruct languages even thousands and thousands of years before these proto-West Germanic dialects were spoken, which is quite exciting, but we won't go any further back than that for now.
That feels like a threat. For now.
However, I will share some other fun linguistic tidbits about proto-West Germanic. So another thing that we do have evidence of is that a few words in these specific dialects had undergone a meaning shift that would distinguish them from words that sound basically identical in, say, Norse languages. And so words like thing, we talked about the all thing, and Norse and previous, and so other Germanic dialects and languages had that word thing as something that meant like a congregation or a gathering or a meeting. But these people had already undergone a meaning shift in the word thing to mean just sort of, well, a thing.
And another, you know, a thing.
And another one that I like is the word that's the ancestor of the word greet, because the word greet originally meant to cry or to wail.
I'm greeting!
Exactly. And in these West Germanic dialects, it underwent a meaning change that was basically from something like to cry or to wail to maybe to complain or to bring something to someone's attention, which then became, then took on the sense of to greet somebody, to basically, well, yeah, greet. I don't know another word for it.
But it is preserved in its original sense in Scottish English.
Yes, exactly.
And in Scots.
Yes, which borrowed it from, more directly from those Norse languages, which still have the word as a way of saying cry or wail.
Another, we've talked a lot about vocabulary up to this point. Another important thing to note about these West Germanic languages, and probably the biggest structural difference between the West Germanic languages and modern English, is grammatical gender. In the modern day English language, gender is just a thing that you put in your email signature. Whereas, obviously, in most Romance languages, and in most Germanic languages as well, even to this day, every noun has to have a gender, whether it's, you know, male, female, or neuter, or, you know, different languages have different genders. English has lost that, you may have noticed. And the story of how it loses it is going to be an important part of what makes English distinctive, or will make English distinctive, from the rest of the family of languages that it descends from.
Yeah.
Before anybody writes in, any Dutch people who want to say, actually, no, the Dutch doesn't have a grammatical gender either. It's like, yes, it does. Look it up. It's very arcane, but yes, it does.
Yeah, I think in a more general sense, especially in European languages are often divided by linguists into, this is, sorry, a bit technical, what's known as analytic languages and synthetic languages. And basically, the short form explanation of this is that synthetic languages are languages like German and Latin, and these are languages that are full of things like grammatical gender and declension. And in particular, they are languages where words themselves are often altered to impart meaning into a sentence. And so in these languages, often word order doesn't matter very much at all. Mm. So in German, you could say something like, the dog ate the cat. But through changing the specific words that you're using things like different cases, you could theoretically change the word order in that sentence in any way that you like, and the meaning would not change grammatically. You could say the dog ate, or the dog, the cat ate, and so on. And there are ways to say that sentence so that the meaning does not change at all. And we don't have this in English because English is an analytic language. We don't tend to change words themselves as much, but we do tend to change around word order and add in extra words. So yeah, the important thing that you should be getting out of this is that English, like grammar and syntax, are very different at this point, as are basically all of its other qualities. It sounds different, it looks different, it is constructed different. And the rest of this episode will be an exploration of how that gradually begins to change. So we don't know exactly what happens next. Really, the only thing we can say with much certainty is that people come to Great Britain from the continent. In terms of things say with confidence, with complete confidence, that's basically as far as it goes.
So here is where we get into a very fun bit of semantics and disagreement between the sources and what we actually know to be true. So Gildas, who again is our closest thing we have to a contemporary source about this period, calls the people who settle in modern-day England in the 5th century, he calls them the Saxons. Basically, he says the Saxons were invited by the Britons for protection against the Picts, the raiding Picts, and Irish. And of course, he says, and the Saxons, once invited, decided to stay and keep arriving. Now, the Venerable Bede, who draws, it was even less contemporary to this process, who draws on Gildas as a source. It's a little bit more nuanced.
He's 8th century, right?
Yes. So he claims that the settlers came from three tribes. The Jutes from Jutland in northern Denmark, the Saxons from Saxony in modern-day Germany, and the Angles from what is now southern Denmark. Now, in Bede's version, each of these three tribes formed a number of kingdoms. So the Jutes set up Kent, the Saxons set up Wessex, Essex, and Sussex, and the Angles set up Northumbria, Mercia, and East Anglia. But the archaeology does not agree with this at all. So whilst there is some evidence of, you know, for example, Jute, people who seem to have come from Jutland living in Kent, you also have people, lots of people in the archaeological record who seem to be living in the quote-unquote wrong place, basically. Based on burials, you have people who dress like Saxons and have a lot of Saxon things living and being buried in places like Northumbria and East Anglia, which again would be a bit weird if you were expecting three distinct tribes to split into seven-ish kingdoms. And in fact, you see lots and the archaeology suggests that lots and lots of people came from even further afield than that, from Sweden, from what is now France, from, and we mentioned before, Frisians and there's basically like the entire like northwestern seaboard of the of continental Europe that has German people in it seems to have flowed over to Britain. And I'm using flow here in a way that sounds very impersonal, but again, I'm being very deliberate here because what happened? Like, why? How did they come? Who came? In what numbers? I mean,
yeah, it's hard to know. The origins of a lot of these people are quite obscure. A lot of the names that we have for them are given by the Romans or by sources after the fact. They might not even be the names by which these people referred to themselves. I mean, take the Jutes, for instance. We actually have basically no evidence that they came from or lived in Jutland. And actually, the term, like, Jutland is, and the, in particular, the Jut part literally just means, like, Jut. It means peninsula. And so it's also a generic term from that area for peninsula.
Brilliant. So helpful.
And it's also possible that the people who are referred to as the Jutes might be a completely different people who are falsely associated after the fact with the Jutes. Although we have a bit more confidence about the Angles and the Saxons. We know the Saxons are more or less from the area known now as Saxony. I don't know if you know where the name Saxon comes from.
I do not.
So the word Saxon comes from originally a word that was used to refer to a type of knife or short sword that these people carried that was called a Sax knife, basically.
Nice.
And this is a word that comes from the same origin as words that we get through Latin, like section and insect. So it's a word whose root basically
the cutters.
Means cut, yeah. So they were essentially people of the knife, which I quite like because it's also the origin via Latin, I believe, of the word sex, as in a division of the genders. Sax and Saxon and Saxa also became relatively common German surnames referring to people who had origins in that area. So it is also through that same root that we have the name of the saxophone, which was named after its inventor. I think his name was Adolphus Sax or Adolf Sax.
Been to the town he was born, and they are big on saxophones. You cannot move for saxophones.
Yeah, or sexophones, you could call them, since, you know, if two words come from the same root, they're basically the same word.
So I think that the translation of the Saxons as the people of the knife is a really, really evocative one, especially because of what we know about the Saxons from contemporary sources. So I said we don't have any sources from this period really, to talk about these people. That's not entirely true. We don't have any British sources. But we do have an account from a Gallic-Roman aristocrat named Sidonius Apollinarius, who made a brief description of Saxons in a letter to a friend, where he said, "The Saxon is the most ferocious of all foes. It comes upon you without warning. When you expect his attack, he slips away. Resistance only moves him to contempt. A rash opponent is soon down. Shipwrecks to him are no terror, but only so much training. He is no mere acquaintance with the perils of the sea. He knows them as he knows himself." Interesting. Interesting foreshadowing there. Perhaps that experience might get reversed at a later date. Put a pin in that.
Yeah, and the etymology of Anglia and angle is not completely agreed upon. It's possible that it comes from a word that means narrow, referring to sort of narrow straits that these people lived by in northern modern-day Germany. It's also possible that it comes from a word that is the ancestor of the modern English angle.
No.
Which is probably not surprising, and in that case, the word would refer to either of its two senses. So it could refer to a hook-shaped or angular area of land sticking out into the sea, or it could refer to them as people who fish, so angling. As anglers. So they may well be the people of the hook.
That's great.
So yeah, we could refer to England as hook land. Hookia.
Hook knife land.
Yeah. The hooky knifies.
Hook knife Britain.
Well, this was how Anglo-Saxons, like, translated words, you know?
They're a charmingly literal people.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, to come back to the point about being vague about how these Germanic peoples made it to Britain, like, on what terms did they arrive? We don't know. How many of them arrived? We don't know. We do have one intriguing bit of archaeological evidence to help us, which is that in the very earliest quote-unquote Anglo-Saxon burials, we don't have any evidence of social hierarchies. So we don't have any evidence of, people who have like way more swords in their graves, for example. Which is what we would expect if we were seeing sort of entire sort of tribal kingdoms or tribal communities migrating over. What we seem to see, at least for the very, very earliest settlers, is probably more indicative of them being independent, freeholding homesteaders, basically.
Small businesses.
Yeah, well, the analogy I would use...
Entrepreneurs.
I think our audience is going to hear that and think, they were anarchists. No. What they probably were basically like the guys on the Oregon Trail.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty apt way of looking at it.
I know we always come back to Wild West analogies, but come on.
Yeah, I mean, Wild West, it's the, Middle Ages, it's the Wild West of... European history, in a way.
Yeah. And if you think about it, Europe is even more west than the Wild West.
Yes.
Because it all just comes around.
What goes around comes around.
Ain't like that just Magellan. The way?
And this understanding that it might not have been a sudden or complete or violent takeover, at least in the beginning, is in stark contrast to the kind of scholarly consensus that was held for... basically most of modern history until quite recently, really until the end of the 20th century, people thought that these Germanic marauders had come over in hordes and basically just executed and massacred the innocent Celts en masse, the innocent Britons. And
and I'm sure some of that did happen.
Yes, definitely. Definitely, violence was probably involved, coercion was probably involved. I'm sure there were threats, some thinly veiled, some not. I'm sure that as Gildas claims, some of them were invited to help fend off people from the north, as well as other Germanic people coming over who were violent. You have to remember that these were probably Britons, that the Britons that were living in Britain at the time were probably quite desperate. They probably were not very organized. They had basically had their entire governmental and military structures ripped away from them.
And if you're wondering, why did they invite a bunch of smelly Germans over to save them? Like, what, isn't that obviously a terrible idea? You got to remember that in the late Roman period, this was just the way you solved problems.
Yeah, and sometimes your, you know, solutions ended with the Goths sacking Rome. Sometimes it ended with other people sacking Rome, but when you're living in a, you know, highly militarized society and, you know, expansionist politics are your only way of succeeding, like, you're going to have to bring in some auxiliaries.
Them's the breaks. Sometimes it goes to plan, sometimes they steal your entire country.
Yep.
And you're still mad about it 1,500 years later.
Exactly.
You write songs about it that you sing at football games. I see you, Welsh people.
And one of the reasons why this idea of a violent conquest and mass killings was so popular was because, interestingly, the English, and we will slowly start to call it English, yes, the Germanic language, which is basically an early form of Old English, which is spoken by people living in Britain after these migrations have begun to bring a lot of people over, basically shows almost no influence from these indigenous Celtic people.
Yeah, there are basically, what is it, 30 Celtic or 30 words from that we think are from Old Brittonic in English.
Yeah, and I think that's in Old English specifically. Yeah. If we cut out things that would be probably regarded as quite regional, like the word Tor, which is used in Scotland quite a bit, but might not be widely understood, say, in all of England, then we get a couple words, essentially, that...
What do you mean? You have Tor. You have a Tor. You have plenty of Tors. You have plenty of Tors in England. Glastonbury Tor.
Yeah, but people don't really use it.
That's true.
Used in place names, I would say, like proper names, but people wouldn't say, oh, walk up that Tor over there, which is something that I've heard people say in Scotland more frequently. So, yeah, if we look at words that would be regarded as widely understood English words today, we have bin and crag. And those are also not completely certain to be, have been adopted from those Britons. And so this is specifically words that would have been adopted by the Anglo-Saxons at the time of their migration to Britain from the indigenous people who spoke a Brittonic language that had not yet evolved into Welsh and Cornish and the other insular Celtic languages. So that's an important distinction, because you might be thinking, oh, but we have all sorts of words from various Celtic languages. Banshee, whiskey, penguin. Clan. Penguin, apparently.
Let me check that. Because that feels true. Okay, so the unfortunately, it is disputed.
Aww.
But people think probably of Welsh origin.
Yeah.
Welsh people are on boats. They're sailing around the world seeing penguins. They ended up in Argentina for some reason.
Yeah, I can believe that.
Anyway.
Yeah, so again, very, very little influence, much less than I think we would expect to see if we look at comparable events, which will be discussed later. But for instance, the Gauls, a different Celtic people who lived in continental Europe and were conquered by the Latins, they contributed lots of words to late Latin that eventually came, you know, to French and to English. So words like battle and battery, a lot of violent words. combat, brave, embassy, mutton, dune, and car.
Thank you, Gauls.
So yeah, and that's like, from what I understand, that's like Asterix and Obelix, basically.
Yes.
So Asterix and Obelix. That's what they are.
They're the last free Gauls.
Yeah, they gave us all of those lovely words. And yeah, when you hear mutton, battle, brave, combat, you do think Asterix and Obelix.
Yeah, I was gonna say, those are sort of their favorite things.
Yeah, exactly.
Roasted meats and punching Romans up directly upwards.
Yeah, exactly. Into the sky. A mean uppercut.
Yes.
So, And I think, yeah, one of the reasons why this is so confusing is because it questions a lot of our assumptions about language contact and the dynamics of it. Because if we look at genetic studies of British people both today and of skeletons from around this time period, we find a population that was integrated, like, to a pretty significant extent. So we have skeletons of people with mixed backgrounds, Celtic and Germanic backgrounds, appear pretty quickly after we know these migrations began to happen. And if we look at people today who originate from Great Britain, the percentage of genetic material they have that's Germanic in origin, and that's from any Germanic source, so both from these migrations or even from later Nordic sources, is less than half. So, although, so this doesn't, definitely does not support a population replacement at all, but it's hard to know exactly what the dynamics were, and probably there was a lot of regional diversity in how these yes. two groups of people got on. But we do have some really interesting cases. So I read one about a gravesite in Cambridgeshire, where there were quite a few burials, and these were ones where there were status differences, and there was a Celtic woman who was given the highest status burial in the burial ground. She was given a more prestigious burial than several Anglo-Saxon women.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is we don't know, to be honest, like, what happened? Like, I don't think there's any, like, the way that I make peace with that is because this is a drib-drab thing, because people aren't arriving as part of an invading army, because there's no Anglo-Saxon policy on the Britons, as it were, you would expect to see a huge amount of hyper-local variation in how people interact and how people were treated. And so, of course, none of the explanations for why Old English is so un-Celtic, of course, none of them would be completely satisfying.
Yeah. We do know it wasn't all sunshine and daisies, though, because we know some people fled. There were refugees.
Yes. And where did they end up?
Brittany.
Yeah, that's right. That's why, hysterically, for the former territory of Gaul, the last Celtic language standing is completely unrelated.
Yes. Yeah, and so that's why Breton and Welsh are quite closely related, and, and Cornish as well. One principle that is generally agreed to guide how languages interact with each other is prestige. And so languages that have more cultural prestige tend to surpass those that don't in usage. And so I think we can assume, especially knowing what we know about like the status of Celtic people and English people later on in the Middle Ages, I think we can assume that there was eventually a much greater status attached to Anglo-Saxonness than there was to native Britonness. But beyond that, yeah, it's hard to say. And it's hard to know exactly how much influence there is in English. It's possible that there is influence that we just don't know about, and that's stuff that we probably never will know about. So some features in English that are quite unique to it, people have proposed that they might originate from that initial contact with these Britons. But again, we just don't know. So for instance, like the way that English people use do you have that, you know, I do not know, do you think, etc. That's not really a construction that's used in basically any other European language.
Although, no, in Dutch, for example, it's have you.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you this.
Yeah, and so some people have compared it to a slightly similar way of constructing sentences that exists in Welsh and I think some other insular Celtic languages, but it's really a fringe theory. It's not widely accepted.
It's pretty satisfying, though.
Yeah. We could natter on for probably hours, and many people have, about the many things that we don't know and will never know about how this whole scenario went down and the many different theories that there are. But instead, let's talk about something that is a little bit more concrete that you can actually look at with your eyes and hold in your hands, and that's writing.
Yes, because the Anglo-Saxons, which I am going to start using this term for this period because look, I know it's contentious, but also give me something that's as instantly recognizable as the term Anglo-Saxon and less ponderous than Germanic peoples in the mid-5th century who traveled to Britain, and I will use it.
Yeah, exactly.
But we are stuck with Anglo-Saxon because nothing fits that bill at the moment. It should be obvious at this point why Anglo-Saxon is kind of a problematic term.
Just look up what we said about Vikings.
Yeah, it's that.
Yeah, there's only so many times in the course of talking about history you can say this term isn't great, or things might not be as clear-cut as you think, but we do need words to talk about things, and these are the words that we're using.
So, speaking of the things that we said about Vikings, let's return to a theme from that episode, which is literacy. So, like Old Norse, Old English was written down, but it was written down using runes. And runes and the runic alphabet, for reasons that I will not relitigate, go listen to that episode, did not serve the same social function that writing does today. It was generally, like, the longest runic inscriptions we have anywhere in Europe, certainly for Old Norse, are like a few hundred characters long. Like, it's a tweet. And most of them are like...
Most of them sound like tweets.
Yeah. Interesting. Looking into it. Thanks.
Mom died today.
Oh, no. Concerning, ... But yeah, no, so this everything that we said about Old Norse and Old Norse runic inscriptions applies to English. You have an English runic alphabet that we do see being used by the Anglo-Saxons to make inscriptions, but not to write stuff down. They weren't telling, this isn't how they told stories, it's not how they expressed political power, and so on. Speaking of political power, it's at about a century after the initial settlement of Britain by the Anglo-Saxons that we first start to see evidence of any kind of Anglo-Saxon kingship. So the evidence that we start to see is, yes, fancier and fancier burials that are specific to, like, very, very small number of people. But also, here's a question for you, Olivia. What is the thing that Anglo-Saxon kings love more than anything else on Earth?
Their homies?
They love... No, take two letters off of that.
Their hoes.
Their homes. Oh. They love building a big hall. Oops. They love a gigantic wooden house where they can have, where they can swill beer with their finest warriors.
Well, yeah, it's all, I think, in a sense, it is both about the homes, the hoes, and the homies.
Yes, exactly. That is what a hall is. Although, I hate to burst the bubble, but unfortunately, the great Anglo-Saxon drinking halls that we're all very enamored with probably were only around for like 50 years. It was like kind of a fad.
Yeah, it was like the Roaring Twenties.
I'll never die. This will never get old.
When she crashes your horse.
But point being, this is the point at which we start to see, social hierarchy and any kind of like meaningful political power and coercion. And the question is, why do we see that? What makes this change? Well, I would again cast our minds back to the Viking episode, and I'd like to ask you, Olivia, what happened in Northern Europe in the mid-6th century?
Natural disaster?
Yes, catastrophic natural disasters, which we know almost certainly affected Britain. Not to the same apocalyptic degree that it, like, wiped out half of Scandinavia and probably made the Vikings real weird, but it was a disaster, and in that moment, people almost certainly would have turned to the people who could provide stability and, most importantly, bread.
All right, well, if you insist.
Do the thing. Say the thing. You've been waiting to say this for a week.
Dance, monkey. Yes, so We have a lot of information about Anglo-Saxon society, even before they were writing with the Latin alphabet, through a lot of the words that they used, which remain, even into modern English, attestations of the values and the culture of these people. So one of my favorite examples, I love to talk about this, I've posted about it before on the internet, is the words lord and lady. And so the long and short of it is that there was a word in Old English that sounded something like hlaf, and this is the ancestor of the modern day word loaf. And so there were two compound words in Old English, and we will get way deep into Old English compound words very soon, but let's stick to these two. So there was a word that was something like hlaford, and this was a compound of hlaf and a word that meant ward, essentially, or warden. It was the ancestor of the modern word ward. So hlaford, and that basically meant what it says on the tin. Loaf ward, bread guardian. And there was another word that was a sort of feminine equivalent of this word that was a compound of hlaf and a word that was something like dio. And that word meant basically like maker or kneader of bread. And so this word hlafward became hlaford, hlaford, and eventually was simplified into lord. And hlafdia eventually was simplified to lafdia and lafdi, and eventually lady. So lord literally means guardian of bread, and lady literally means maker of bread. And so that's pretty fun. There was a third word which did not survive into modern English that meant something like manservant, that translated to like eater of bread. And so, yeah, this is a attestation to the importance of these family bonds and these bonds of protection that existed during this time period, when things were very politically unstable and protection was very much clan-based. And you had groups of people who would be perhaps family relations, but also perhaps just clans, so to speak, by choice, and you would all be sworn to protect one another. They loved oaths, and if you were in one of these clans with someone, then you could be held accountable for their actions, and vice versa. And so these were basically the bricks and mortar of Anglo-Saxon society. There wasn't much central control. From what we understand, it took quite a while for these groups of people to coalesce into larger and more stable kingdoms. Things were very clan-based, and this was also preserved in the Anglo-Saxon legal system, which has a lot in common with the Viking legal system, which we've discussed before, but essentially it wasn't very heavy on due process, and it was very heavy on oaths.
And betting an Inuit guy that you can shoot.
Yeah.
If you can't shoot better than him, you'll kill yourself.
Exactly. And so we had things like if you wanted to bring someone to trial, then if they could get more people to swear oaths on their behalf than you could, then they would win the trial and you might be punished instead of them. And similar dynamics where
I'm pretty sure that happened in an episode of Better Call Saul.
Yeah, to be fair, it's not like extremely different to, I guess, how like modern court systems work.
Well, it's different enough. Your Honor, trust me. Trust me and these 50 gigantic men standing behind me.
No, it was great. And you had different, like, different people had different values to their oaths. So you could get like one thane. Or you could get five churls, you know, like it was, there was a whole exchange rate as well. It was fascinating. They had a very fascinating approach to solving legal disputes. Another way that you could compensate for things, legal damages, was if you murdered someone, you could just pay some money and basically have the whole thing written off. So, pretty convenient. But of course,
thankfully we don't use that today.
In classic Anglo-Saxon fashion, the amount of money that you had to pay depended on how important the person that you killed was. Were they a slave? Were they important? Were they powerful? And this money was known as the weregeld.
Yes.
And that basically means man money. So when you hear the word werewolf, the were means man.
Man-wolf.
Makes sense. Man-wolf. Wolf-man.
Another bit of evidence that we have from the pre-literary era of Anglo-Saxon history about Old English is in place names, because I think especially like Americans and other English speakers who don't grow up in Britain are quite thrown by how wild and inconsistent place naming is and how inconsistent place name pronunciations are. And part of the reason for that is just the insane patchwork of English history and how all these different languages have come together and influenced, you know, place names. And so the phonetics of place names in England are just wildly inconsistent. So we're going to be sprinkling a few of these throughout these episodes. And I want to talk about a few Anglo-Saxon place name suffixes, because they loved suffixes. So the first of these, well, it's actually technically an import from Latin, but anything that has Chester, Cester, or Caster at the end of it, so Lancaster, Leicester, or Chester, is the site, or is associated with the site, of a former Roman castrum, or fort. That's the one that everybody learns in school. But did you further know that Ing, so I-N-G,
Ing, Arking, Dorking.
Mm-hmm, yes, Reading, means people of. So Reading is the is Rheda's people. So it just means, presumably, that at some point in time, this settlement was led by somebody called Rheda. How about Ham?
Ham means a village, like hamlet.
Yes, farm or settlement. So Birmingham, for example, probably means Bayorma's settlement. Mm. Here's another good one, Wick or Witch. So this generally means a settlement that was dedicated to artisanship or a type of trade, as opposed to farming. So Norwich and Ipswich and Berwick are all major ports from very early on in the Anglo-Saxon period. Last one, Borough, or Borough, as it shows up in Scottish English. This means a fort or fortified town. So Middlesbrough, Edinburgh, Peterborough. Yeah. Anything that has a borough in it. And even just the word borough itself later just survives into modern English as a word that means, like, a municipality.
Yeah, and of course that's cognate with the German word Bürger.
Yes.
So Hamburger is someone from Hamburg. Hamburg, I guess, you know.
Settlement fort.
Yeah, maybe. It's possible, actually. I don't know that one for sure. But,
could be.
There's also a few place names I should point out which are probably Brittonic in origin. So among them are Avon, anything with Avon. Avon means river, so the River Avon, of course, is the River River.
Your da sells river, as we used to say in school.
Yes, Thames is probably originally Brittonic in origin. Probably means something like dark or murky, which...
It sure be that.
And Manchester... So the Chester, of course, comes from the Latin castrum, as you already said, but the man part, do you know what that means?
Man.
No.
What does it mean?
Boob.
Yeah!
Boob Castle!
Woo!
Yeah!
I need to get myself on a train.
Yeah.
My wings are shaking, I'm gently leaving.
So, the Anglo-Saxons did eventually convert to Christianity in sort of fits and starts over the course of the 6th and 7th centuries. There was no singular Anglo-Saxon conversion. Different kingdoms converted at different times for different reasons. I'm not going to get into it. And they were heavily influenced by missionary work from both Ireland and Rome. Now, this process has two major influences on English. One that is very well easy to substantiate, and another one that is much, much harder to substantiate. The very easy thing to substantiate is that when they became Christians, the Anglo-Saxons started writing things down enthusiastically in an alphabet they pretty much copied from Latin, with a couple of exceptions. So they did add some letters that were just carried over from the old runic alphabet. So, for example, the thorn symbol, which is sort of like a weird-looking P, and the F, which is a weird-looking D, both sort of have a th sound to them. And the Wynn, as in the Wynn Resort and Casino, is featured in Paul Blart Mall Cop 2, which is a weird-looking D, is a sort of W sound. So, and of course they didn't adopt Arabic numerals until much, much later in the Middle Ages, but they basically started writing the way that Romans write.
Yeah, I mean, there were a few Roman letters they didn't, like, need, like J. Just didn't have much use for that one. I actually think that one hadn't been invented yet, but a K they didn't need at all.
Still don't need K. We really still don't need it.
They kind of got it. They were like, we have S and we have C, and that really kind of, you know, covers the whole spectrum.
And then some genius later.
Some clown.
I'm going to ruin this language forever.
Yeah, exactly. And Z as well was not something that they needed particularly. And the distinction between U and V at this point was not very clear.
Mm.
So anyways, but basically the same alphabet.
Yeah.
And it should be mentioned as well that the runic alphabet is probably derived from Latin or an ancestor, the Latin alphabet or an ancestor, as far as we know.
Yeah, it does look vaguely Latin-ish.
And as far as we know, only one alphabet has ever been invented from scratch in the history of the world.
What is that?
Oh, well, it's the Latin alphabet and its family.
Boo. It's what? Disappointing. I thought you were going to say something wild. Okay, so the first thing that's easy to substantiate is Christianity brings writing. The other thing that's harder to substantiate, but probably is true to an extent, is that Christianity brings a lot of Latin words into English. Now, I'm not saying there's any debate as to whether there are lots of Latin-derived words in Old English. There absolutely are. So to go through a few of them, so there's a lot of secular words that aren't related to Christianity, like street, which is derived from strata, wine, which is derived from vinum, and inch, which is derived from unica. But there are, of course, also lots of ecclesiastical words related to scholarship and faith. So pope from papa, school from scola, and monk from monachus. Now, it would be easy to presume that these words came along with Christianity when Anglo-Saxons converted. Unfortunately, there's basically no way to prove that because they weren't writing stuff down before they were Christian.
Yep.
And so it is entirely... Look, the people who came from the Germanic Northern Europe to England in the 5th century, that we later call Anglo-Saxons, they were living on the Roman frontier. It is entirely possible that the languages that they spoke in their homelands had lots of Latin loanwords in them. We will never be able to really confidently state how, at what exact point certain words entered Old English before Christianization. So one of the big challenges of dating influences on Old English is that a lot of the oldest sources that were written down after Christianization are preserved in manuscripts that are much younger than the texts that they are preserving, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, for example, the Law Code of Æthelbert of Kent, which is one of the oldest things ever written in Old English, is not preserved in the original 5th century manuscript. It's preserved in something from, like, the 11th century. And if there's one thing you should remember about medieval scholarship is that we can't trust them to preserve authentic archaicisms at all. They would have absolutely used the language of their time. They would have been like, I don't know, like you know how every couple of years somebody comes out with a new translation of a classical text where it's like the word, or for example, a new translation of Beowulf where the word what is translated as yo.
Yeah.
Where it's like, well, that's kind of what it is, but also I think you're missing the point.
Yep.
So it's really hard to date this.
But that being said, I will say that we can definitely connect the introduction of literacy in English to a massive increase in the vocabulary.
Mm.
And that's because of the introduction of an Old English literary tradition. So goodbye oral tradition. Just kidding. That still exists too. People are still telling each other stories, but they're also writing those stories down. and developing poetic forms and meters and standards. And writing words down lets you use more words, it lets you remember more words, it lets other people use your words, and there are a lot of poetic conventions that exist amongst the Anglo-Saxons and the North Germanic people in general that require new words to be coined. And so, for instance, Anglo-Saxon poetry has a very heavy emphasis on alliteration. And so we want, if we're Anglo-Saxons, poems to have similar sounds at the beginnings of each word. So here is one example of an Anglo-Saxon poem. This is a charm to calm down bees. Sitta ye siga wife, sigath to earthen, nefrage wilda to wooda fliegen, beoge swaga mindiga, menas godis, swa byth mana gewilk metis und idelis. So we have very similar placements of specific words beginnings throughout that poem.
It has a nice rhythm to it.
It does. And so Anglo-Saxons are really big on coining new compound words, because even if you have a character or an object in a story, you might need 5 or 6 or 7 or more ways to refer to that thing so that you can keep track of and keep hold of your poetic meter and your form. And so they get all into coining words that are compound words for simple objects that are used in poetry. And lots of those words are still in use today. So for instance, sunbeam is one example, and rainbow. Those are words that date back to the Anglo-Saxons. We've got all sorts in poems like Beowulf. Whale road is one that's been questioned a little bit, but you could make that argument.
Well, it's a compound word that means something.
Yeah, there are great Christian ones, so there are a lot for instance, devil. The devil is referred to in Old English as things like hell limper is one of them, I believe. Old foe is another one. You have dragons being referred to by things like, you know, poisoned serpent and whatnot.
Which again, to interrupt here a little bit, is a very classically Germanic thing to do. I think compared to its relatives, English is not really associated with long compound words like German is, for example. But that's because I think a lot of the things that are compound words in English are quite old and have just been, their compoundness have kind of been forgotten.
Yeah.
Like sunbeam, for example.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Like it is obviously a compound of two words, but you don't think about it in those terms because it's short, it's snappy, it's just in English. People aren't coming up with lots of new compound words now, is my point.
Yeah. So here's a few more in English that date back to Old English that you might not realize are compound words. Daisy comes from day's eye. Never comes from nay ever. That's right. Nothing is from non-thing.
Yeah.
Garlic comes from gar, which is a archaic word that means spear, and leek. And Fortnite.
Sorry, I know you mean the other one.
No, I mean the game. They were playing that in Old English.
I want to get the Beowulf skin.
So yeah, do you know where Fortnite comes from?
No, I genuinely don't.
So hard to say that with a straight face.
It comes from Epic Games, yeah. Limited.
Well, how long is a Fortnite?
2 weeks.
How many nights is that anyways?
14.
14 Fuck! Nights.
That's How did right. I never cluck that, ever?
It's wild.
That's insane.
Yeah, so we have a lot of poetic words that can be attributed to our friends, the Anglo-Saxons. So yeah, as you might have noticed from that very badly pronounced poem I read out, what we are referring to as Old English is old indeed. It does not sound very much at all still like what we would consider to be English in a modern sense. But again, that is changing slowly over the course of the Middle Ages. We know that there's quite a bit of diversity in the various dialects of Old English, but also as political situations throughout England, and now it is actually referred to as England, and English people are referred to as the English, so we have our first uses of those words already at the very onset of English literacy. And so now something resembling English language and English identity are slowly taking shape, even though they are still much, much more Germanic than they are today.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the words that these Anglo-Saxons used are still words that we use today, even though modern English is much less Germanic. In fact, I think only something like 25% of the words in modern English are estimated to be Germanic in origin. That is, nevertheless, still, I think, all but 3 or 4 of the 100 most common words in English. And those 100 most common words make up about half of all words that are spoken in English.
Yeah.
So most of what we speak is still very much Germanic. And I think you can feel that when you go somewhere like the Netherlands or Germany. Yes.
Or if you hear a language like Friesian, which is really unsettling because it basically sounds like somebody from Norfolk speaking Dutch badly. It's incredible. Speaking of Germanic and the vague concept of the North, there is another Germanic influence that does arrive in English in the early Middle Ages, and this is the influence of Old Norse. And this comes to us from our old friends, the Vikingur, the Vikings. So, raiders from Scandinavia and Denmark start raiding poorly defended coastal communities in what will later become England, Ireland, and Scotland, from around 793 onwards. Now, for the first 50-odd years, they're just raiders. They don't settle or even overwinter in England at all, although they do. Some do in Ireland and Scotland, but at this point, neither of those areas are English-speaking, so not relevant to our story. However, from 865 onwards, we see a real step change in the type and the intensity of Norse raiding. So the raiding parties become much, much larger. We start hearing them being referred to as armies or hordes. Quick sidebar, by the way, horde, you know where that comes from?
Nordic.
Mongolian. It's one of the only it's one of the only Mongol loanwords in English. And interestingly, this is a total sidebar, but also that's what you come here for. So horde comes from the word ordu. And one of the interesting things about the word horde in English is that it's almost kind of the exact opposite of its meaning in Mongol.
Huh.
So a Mongolian horde was a very sort of well-organized, mobile political community with institutions and with hierarchies and so on. Whereas one of the things I think that is distinctive about the word horde in English is that it has a chaotic implication.
Yeah.
A horde sweeps in rather than sort of marches in. And so one of the only uses of the word horde correctly in English is in the movie Furiosa, a Mad Max saga.
Whoa.
where Chris Hemsworth's character describes his gigantic army of thousands of bikers that are commanded by him as a horde.
Hmm.
The only thing that horde has in common in English with its Urdu root is the idea of it being mobile and movement being central to it. Anyway, that was a sidebar. Just thought that would be interesting. So from the late 9th century, the Norse start arriving in larger numbers. They start overwintering in England, and eventually they start actively conquering territory and killing kings. They take out the kings in Northumbria, East Anglia, and Mercia. And the conquest is only halted when Alfred, of the great fame, the King of Wessex, defeated the Norse at the Battle of Edington in 878. Now, subsequent to that, a peace treaty was agreed, dividing the territory of what is now England in two. The western part of England, as well as the southeast and the far north, so like now what is now Northumberland, were under English control, whereas East Anglia, Yorkshire, Essex, and the Midlands were all under Norse rule, where Norse law would apply. This is called
the Dane Law.
The Dane Law. And this is the point which we start to see large-scale settlement by Norse people in the east of England. Now, the use of the word Dane Law, this is very deliberate, because you want to know one of the words that we get from the Vikings?
Dane Law.
Nope. Shorten it. Law.
Law.
The word law is an Old Norse term. It is derived from the word log, which means something that is laid down.
Ah.
So you lay down the law.
There you go. You're gonna have a law down.
Yeah.
Interesting. Does that, do you know if that bears any connection to the like Scottish word law, like as in hill or mountain?
I genuinely have no idea. It could be completely unrelated.
Because hills kind of lay down atop the earth.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things, as we've kind of talked about before, is that unlike some of the other languages that have either influenced or not influenced English up to this point, like Brittonic, like Latin, Norse is obviously much, much more closely related to English, but you still see a lot of loan words carrying over. And a lot of these are actually quite day-to-day stuff. So, for example, the word window, which comes from vindolga, which replaced the old English word eghol, which literally means...
Airhole?
Eyehole.
Eyehole, nice. Yes.
Here are some other random examples of words that we get straight from Old Norse. Band, bank, bull, crook, dirt, egg, fellow, freckle, girth, kid, leg, link, loan, race, reindeer, rift, root, scales, score, sister, skill, skirt, sky, slaughter. Very Viking word there.
But wait.
Steak.
I'm a non-binary Viking.
Yes! Old English and Old Norse are both, as we talked about before, Germanic languages that have grammatical gender. But of course, these are not the same languages, and so the gender of words operates a little bit differently. It's too complicated or too technical to get into. But essentially what you should bear in mind is that the way that gender worked in each of these languages was a complicating factor that made it harder for Norse people and English people to speak to each other, because although we adopted a lot of words from Old Norse, how mutually intelligible Old English and Old Norse were is, I think, a bit of a scholarly debate to this day. Like, people argue over, like, would you have needed an interpreter? Well, I think the consensus is probably you probably could have muddled through, but it would have been a pain.
Yeah, there is actually a video on YouTube of a guy who speaks Old English and a guy who speaks Old Norse trying to talk to each other. And they do manage to muddle through, but to me it's a little bit cheating because they obviously both speak English as their first language. And so I think they're probably... in some ways, able to choose their words.
Mm-hmm.
So, to be more understandable.
Yeah. So this is the point at which we have, you know, the first large-scale settlement since the Anglo-Saxons' initial migrations. We have a large-scale settlement of non-English-speaking people in England, which means that English evolves to become simpler.
Give a little bit of context about other things that are happening over the course of the earlier part of the Middle Ages in Britain, from around 400 AD up until around the middle of the 11th century, which we will get to later. Not sure what happens.
Does anything
then.
Happen in the 11th century that might influence the direction of English?
I don't think. I think some people put some horses on a boat. Call back. But anyways, throughout this period of time, English is spreading throughout Great Britain, and so it is slowly pushing the frontiers of Welsh and Cornish further and further back, although it will be quite some time yet before Cornish ceases to be spoken, and Welsh will never be fully eradicated.
Just ask Dafydd Evans.
Yes, exactly. And so English is becoming more and more dominant as time goes on. up in the north of Great Britain, Pictish is slowly being pushed back and slowly diminishing.
By Gaelic, it's unrelated.
Yes, so that's not English's fault for once. And politically, things are beginning to stabilize. They're beginning to congeal and conglomerate and condense. And so what was previously a very scattered, very disorganized constellation of various clans and local rulers and a very unstable power system begins to crystallize into larger kingdoms. And so there is a tendency kind of traditionally to say that there were four Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. I think scholars nowadays debate a little bit whether we can say these were four kingdoms, they were the only big kingdoms, and they were mostly stable.
Yeah, so there's... So I think the consensus now is to just say the number of kingdoms in Anglo-Saxon England is uncountable because it depends on how you define king. Lots of kings could be over kings, and the way that they kind of documented who sort of paid tribute to who was very, very complicated, and it didn't make, like, kings were deposing other kings, and then sometimes a Welsh king would come along and, like, chop the head off the Northumbrian king and become the Northumbrian king for a bit. That's right, I know about Cadwallader, it's fine. you don't have to write about it in the comments.
Oh, they still will.
No, Wales, like, the Welsh kingdoms are very much, like, the Brittonic kingdoms are very much still around. Like, the Kingdom of Strathclyde is still kicking, and then and then in Wales, there's Welsh things happening.
And there's also a tendency to associate each of these four traditional kingdoms of Anglo-Saxon England.
So these name them?
These are the Kingdom of Northumbria, which stretches from about Yorkshire to about where modern-day Edinburgh is.
Yorkshire.
Exactly. And
fucking Northumbria. Whereas modern-day Northumbria sort of means vaguely the northeast of England.
Yes, exactly. There is the Kingdom of Kent, which is Kent.
All right, love.
That one's not changed that much. There is Wessex, and that is kind of the whole, like, south of England.
Who are me, lovely? Would you like a cream tea?
You're surprisingly hitting the... I mean, not surprisingly, because this is just England, but yeah, you're hitting the nail on the head in ways that you don't yet even know, or maybe you do. And then there is Mercia, which is basically the middle bit.
Oh no, I've spilled a hot Bovril on myself.
Yeah. Good,
if I'm gonna steal a joke, I'm gonna steal a joke from Stuart Lee.
No, yeah, that's fair. That's fair. And
it's the Midlands.
Yeah.
There's no other jokes about the Midlands.
No, exactly. And so there is a tendency to associate each of these kingdoms with a distinct dialect of Old English.
Mm-hmm.
This is also a bit controversial. We don't necessarily have great records of all of these because during the 9th century, Alfred of Wessex conquers the other kingdoms and unifies them, and they all become Wessex, and then everything starts to be written in West Saxon English. Wessex means West Saxon, same way Essex means East Saxon. And
Sussex means Sus Saxon.
Yes, exactly. And so we don't have amazing records for all of these languages, and something that is also super controversial, there is a lot of controversy, I don't know if you've noticed, in scholarly opinions about the linguistic development of England.
I haven't, surprisingly.
There is a lot of controversy as to how these different dialects develop and the extent to which they are preserved today. So there have been people who have said that, for instance, West Country English best preserves the West Saxon dialect. And I do think that these dialects of Old English did influence regional accents nowadays, but there's often a lot of debate about which version of modern English sounds the most similar to some historical version of English. Like, I don't know if you've heard people say, oh, Shakespeare would have sounded American.
Yeah, a lot of people say that, like, John Adams and George Washington and the American founding fathers would have sounded like they were from the West Country.
Yeah, exactly. But it is true that this West Saxon dialect did strongly influence West Country accents nowadays, just as the Kentish dialect influenced Kentish dialects nowadays. And the Northumbrian dialect as well had a very strong influence because it grew into very strongly regionalized dialects of English, so strongly regionalized, in fact, that they're often considered to be distinct languages from English. So these are the Cumbrian, Northumbrian, and Scots
languages. Sometimes Olivia and I have heated arguments about this when we're trying to cook dinner for 15 people. And it goes about as well as, it's about as productive as you would expect.
Exactly. And so there is, again, a lot of debate about, you know, in particular with Northumbrian, does Northumbrian somehow preserve Celtic languages better than the other dialects? Does it, for instance, preserve some features from Norse settlers and invaders better than other dialects? The latter, I think, is much more easy to prove than the former. But as for the rest, yeah, it's very hard to say exactly whether these dialects were strongly influenced by Celtic or regional differences. So I haven't mentioned that much about Mercian, and that's because although the West Saxon dialect was for a while the ascendant dialect, it was the standard often for written English, for English literature. During this Anglo-Saxon period, although not universally so, the Venerable Bede, for instance, wrote in a Northumbrian dialect.
So we know, please stop writing to me about it, because I did him in a West Country accent that one time. I know, it was
He'll
a deliberate...
He'll be Geordie next time.
It was a deliberate... No, he won't. It was a deliberate creative choice, and I'm sticking with it. I do not care.
No, I'm going to make him Geordie.
This is like potatoes all over again.
Nabosh.
You shouldn't have come at me for this, because now it's a point of principle, and I'm annoyed about it.
He's fucking spitting venom over here. Don't cross this guy. He's angry.
I'm salty like a potato.
Yeah, he's gonna come to your house and hit you.
You should be so lucky.
With a potato.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some people would pay good money for that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You seen the messages I get.
Oh, yeah. Spud me up, please. Spud daddy. Anyways, however, in the end, I think it's the fact that West Saxon English, this Wessex dialect, is the language that's spoken by the people who eventually come to rule over all the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. I think it is that fact that actually dooms West Saxon English in the end, because after
what could that mean?
The Anglo-Saxon period comes to an end, it is no longer dominant. And modern English is generally agreed to be based on, by and large, the Mercian dialect.
Mm.
So what happens to the West Saxons?
You'll have to find out in the next episode. That's right, this is a two-parter. Surprise!
Surprise!
Olivia just announced this to me today. We didn't plan this. This isn't like a big season finale thing. She just said, I have two episodes worth of things to say about this.
That's right.
So, thank you so much. Until next time, when we will be picking up this story with the arrival of some different scary men from over the sea. If you liked this episode, please do leave us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like, you can also leave us a comment on Spotify. And if we like it, we might read it out, as Olivia is about to do.
I should say we like all of your comments. So
yeah,
please keep leaving them. We can only read out a couple. And this week's will be... thank you to Tor Santos, who says, it's good to know that boats have always been holes in the water that you throw money into. Yes, that is what I understand from boat owners, and why I will not become one of them. And
has an instinctive fear of the sea.
That's not true. I just don't like fish. Thank you to Max Turner, who says, there truly is no pick-me-up like seeing a new Weird Medieval Guys episode. No matter how shit of a day I'm having, y'all always make it a little better, heart.
See, thank I you. Wish I wish that I had somebody who could be for me what I am for you. That would sound great.
Yeah, if you're listening to this, start a podcast.
You could, if you're listen, if all of our listeners don't want to feel sad, each one of you start a podcast, and then you can be one individual person's like pick me up.
Yes.
It can be just one gigantic pyramid scheme.
Correct.
Anyway, and also pay us money. Oh, and yeah, until next time, take it easy.
I'm Bernie Madoff, and this has been my podcast.
Whoa, aren't you in jail or something?
Nope.
Now, it's not a very dialogue-heavy series.
No, there isn't. From what I understand, from what I've seen of Skibidi Toilet, which is, to be fair, I think a decent amount.
So there are these guys with cameras on their heads, and there's also people who have TVs on their heads, and they're separate. And they have some sort of, each of these
factions.
That's right,
it's like apartheid.
Yeah, whoa. These sort of, I don't really know how to respond to that. These factions sort of have, they each have their own sort of agenda that I don't understand.
Segregation, from what I understand.
All right, moving swiftly on.